This is the Oracle, and you are listening to Dopey, the podcast on drugs, addiction, and dumb shit. And please stay strong, Dopey Nation. And don't use drugs. Toodles.
Hello and welcome to Dopey, the podcast about drugs, addiction, and dumb shit. And I'm Dave. And that was the Oracle from the third Matrix movie. It was not the first Oracle. It was the second Oracle. And she was kind enough to send a message to the Dopey Nation. I hope you guys are good. I'm at my dad's house. I'm in my childhood bedroom where I actually Skyped a few messages with Chris, who we all know has passed away from a relapse. And, you know, everybody's like, Dave, I hope you're okay, and I hope you're not going to relapse, which I do appreciate. And I think it's very, very nice and cool that so many people are so concerned about me. And I tell everybody that I am not close to using, and that's true. But it's easy to say that. And I feel like it's easy to say that right now, because I'm really not close to using, I'm not close to relapsing, but like, it's very important to know that it's possible, you know what I mean? Like, me telling myself that I'm not close to relapsing, I mean, like, listen, I'm not fucking close to relapsing, but any drug addict is close to relapsing, I guess. Nobody is innocent, nobody is safe. But I do feel pretty safe, you know, I have to say that. I guess I'm saying two things at the same time. I went to a meeting today. It was great. It wasn't like the best meeting I ever went to, and I totally got there a little bit late and sat in the back. But the power of a fellowship is real. And even if you hate fucking 12-step groups and you hate meetings and you hate the idea of being a part of something like that, if you're struggling, you should just fucking go. You know, forgive me for saying this, but you're basically an idiot if you just say you hate it and you don't want to use. Just go. Just pretend. It makes everything so much easier. Having a program, it makes, you do what you do. If you don't want to go, you don't go. But if you're struggling and you're looking for something, that shit is free and it maps everything out. It makes it pretty easy to get your shit together. I've never done Smart Recovery or Refuge Recovery or any of those things, but I hear that they can be successful too. Just go someplace where you could talk to some people and be a part of it. Make what I always like to say is you make your recovery your hobby. And there's this thing that happened since Chris died. I've, I think there was a phenomenon that kind of happened after Chris died, which is everybody who listens to the show obviously freaked out. Downloads went up, and, you know, it was something that I would have normally loved to have shared with Chris, and it was very hard to not be able to share it with him. And I'm trying to share it with basically anybody who will listen to me talk about it. So, I'm sure a lot of you who are listening know that I'm doing that right now. I'm talking to just about anybody that will talk to me about the show. There's like this great hole, and I'm trying, you know, the Chris-shaped hole that I'm trying to fill up with the Dopey Nation. And it has me on my phone a ton. And all of a sudden, I find myself like very dependent on the phone, like even more so than I was. And I was always dependent on the phone. And I knew it was a problem. I just didn't know how much of a problem it was until my daughter came up to me and she said, Daddy, I had this nightmare. And in the nightmare, I was in the front yard and I was playing, and this weird man with a beard and virtual reality goggles came up to me and he kidnapped me. And you were sitting on the front porch and I screamed for you to get me, but you were on the phone. And I was like, ugh, like what a terrible thing to hear from your kid that they're kidnapped and you're looking at the phone. And I find myself like compulsively looking at the fucking phone. So that is something that I need to work on. I don't know if you guys are going through phone addiction, and it's pathetic because how many people are like, look at this motherfucker on the phone, and all of these animations of people like zombies staring at their phone, and I'm walking around Manhattan with my head in the phone. Also, my new job at work has me on the phone. Dopey has me on the phone. And it's like, I need freedom from this phone. And I think I might start using 12-step shit to get off the fucking phone. I am going to play a voicemail. But actually, before I do, I want to tell this quick other story. I'm at work, and this guy I've worked with for a long time, Lenny, who's a fan of the show, comes up to me, and he goes, yo, did you see this new show coming out on Vice? And I said, Vice? I said, no. And he goes, it's called Dope Sick Nation. And Lenny knows all about Dopey. And he's like, I'm like, what? He goes, yeah, it's about these two heroin addicts who are trying to get, you know, traveling the country, finding junkies to get them clean or something. And he goes, didn't you contact Vice? And I was like, yeah, I did contact Vice. In fact, I wrote Vice like 4 emails to their programming director. And I said, you guys do shows about making drugs. You guys do shows about partying. You guys do shows about selling drugs. But you don't do any shows about the repercussions of drugs. And I do this show called Dopey. And we have this fan base that we call the Dopey Nation. And I think it should be a show on Vice. And then basically a year and a half later, they come out with a show called Dope Sick Nation. Do you think that's a coincidence? I don't know. Everybody at my job was sure that they robbed me. Everyone was at my job was telling me that I should get a lawyer to deal with this. And I called up Justin, who was actually on the last show, who was actually a big-time corporate lawyer. And he was saying that there is no case, but we should reach out to this Dope Sick Nation and get them to participate with the show. They should buy ads on Dopey. They should tell their story on Dopey. And I said, okay, well, that's a possibility. And then I spoke to my friend Brad, who is totally pissed at me because those of you who are in the hardcore, real listeners from the beginning know that Dopey was kind of a rip of Brad's idea in the first place. Brad wanted to do a podcast about drugs years ago, way before Dopey, but he wanted it to be like celebrity drug stories. And then when Chris and I started doing Dopey, you know, we had kind of mentioned Brad, but we didn't give him the credit that he deserves. And now Brad is like, you don't even use me in the origin story. You just tell people you thought of the show, or you told me that Chris, you say that Chris wanted to do a project and you wanted to do a project, so you decided to do this podcast. But the truth is, we stole it from Brad. And Brad thinks that there should be some sort of war between the Dopey Nation and the Dope Sick Nation. So you guys in the Dopey Nation, what do you guys think? Do you want to raise up arms against the Dope Sick Nation? I think at least we should be writing some shit to Vice or Viceland and be like, did you come up with this idea independently of Dopey? Or, you know, listen, there is an opiate pandemic. There is truly a Dope Sick Nation, but was that not born in the fires of Dopey? As you guys ponder this question, I am going to play a voicemail that I got from a dude named Chris in Austin, Texas. Wait a second. Before I do that, before I play Chris's voicemail from Austin, Texas, I called my father in. Dad, welcome to the show.
Hello. Hi, everybody.
Now, you were sitting in the living room yesterday, and you read about this show on Vice called Dope Sick Nation.
Dope Sick Nation,
yes. Do you
yes.
think there's a lawsuit here?
I doubt it.
What do you think?
I think that this is an epidemic, and there's a heck of a lot of people who are dope sick, so the Dopey podcast and Dope Sick maybe two separate ideas with the same basis of this epidemic.
You don't think there should be some sort of feud between the two parties, where a jihad between the Dope Sick Nation and the Dopey Nation?
Well, knowing you, I think there's going to be a feud, but
that would really depend on the Dopey Nation and what they're willing to do.
Yeah, I understand.
But of course, I'm sure a lot of the Dopey Nation is actually dope sick right now.
Correct.
So it probably shouldn't be a feud or jihad.
No, actually, maybe you could work together with them.
But what could they do for us?
I don't know. Maybe you could get a larger audience if they would promote dopey.
They're not going to promote dopey.
Well, I think it's a possibility that they may see how good the program is.
This is why I don't put him on the show very well.
Hey, listen, I'm telling you the truth.
Just stop for a second. Imagine you're an executive. I mean, try to use your imagination.
This is going to be hard. Yes,
you're an executive advice, and you get email after email from this, you know, confused, albeit very genius, man who has a podcast called Dopey.
You mean you?
I mean me. Yeah. Telling them of their business in terms of drugs, and they do shows about celebrating drug use. They do shows about...
Yeah, if I was an executive, I would be very interested in you. Absolutely.
Well, my point is, they get the email describing the show, and about 13 months later, they come out with a show very similar based on the points that I gave them.
Do
you think it's a coincidence, or do you think it's based on the open
point? Well, now that you're saying you gave them points on how to...
I wrote them email after email.
Oh, now you're making your case here. That's different. That's different than just having the name Dope Nation versus Dopey. But
they're Dope Sick Nation.
The Dope Sick Nation is copying what you wrote to them. Well, that sounds like something.
Well, but my vision might not have been great. What I told them what I wanted to do was have a talk show for addicts like Dopey. I didn't want to travel the country and save dope sick people.
True. So then it's different. But in any case, find out what the Dopey Nation thinks about this and see what you know.
Dopey Nation, what do you guys think about this?
Right.
Do you have anything else to add?
Not really.
Okay. Thank you for your time.
Bye-bye, everybody.
And now the voicemail from Chris in Austin. But what do you guys think? Do you guys think that this sounds suspect or what?
Hey, Dave. Hey, Dopey Nation. This is Chris from Austin. Man, it's hard to... It's weird to not say, hey, Chris, too. It really sucks. I miss him. And so I'm just driving right now to a HA meeting I go to, Heroin Anonymous. It's just like AA for junkies. I'm actually a year clean today from heroin, but I don't count it as my sobriety date because they gave me Suboxone at detox, and that's like 6 days later. So, and I was a big time Suboxone addict. So, who cares? We're just splitting hairs here. I'm roughly a year clean from fucking opiates, and I'm pretty grateful. And so, I've been a listener of the podcast for a long time. I've had a couple of my voice memos played. And so I thought, you know, the show must go on, as they say. So I thought I would send you in a little voice memo, Dave. And hopefully it's not too rambly. But it's just kind of a funny, lighthearted, dopey story of mine. It's not real, real dopey, but it's definitely drug-fueled. And it was a funny thing that happened the weekend before I got married, which was in 2014, and had a couple friends come into town, and they had asked me, they said, do you want strippers and all that? And I was like, no, I really don't, because I'm really not into all that. Like, I don't like going to strip clubs, and I'm not into paying a girl to be hot and naked. Now, if that's your thing, that's fucking awesome. If you're a stripper, that's even more awesome. Make that money. But, you know, just not my thing. I am a big-time lover of MDMA, though. I mean, I use heroin and opiates to get right, but I use MDMA and psychedelics and stuff to get high and to explore. And so all I wanted to do for the weekend was just take X, which I did all the time, and just go downtown and hit some after-hours techno place that I love. Dave, I'm sure you're probably cringing right now, but Chris liked the tech, I think, a little bit. But that's my shit, man. The downtown, you know, all night techno, just having fun with that, you know. So anyways, my friends are like, okay, cool. When we did that, you know, we took a bunch of tabs and we went down there and it was great. You know, we, like, the first night we just did that, and then the second, like, Saturday night we did the same thing, and then I saw them, you know, on their phones, and they don't live in the city, you know, they don't live here. So, of course, I saw them on their phones. I'm like, oh, great, what are they looking up, you know? And they're like, came up to me at about 3 in the morning, and they're like, because this place, this techno place, goes to like 4:30, 5 in the morning or so. And they're like, come on, Chris, please, let's go to a strip club, please, please. And I'm like, oh, fuck. All right, dude, there's not one going to be one opened. I mean, I hope you can if you can find one that's open, fine, whatever. I'll go, you know, but yeah, I doubt you're going to find one. And so they came back like, I don't know, 15 minutes later and said, we found one, let's go. And I'm like, oh, fuck, all right. I was just into the music, having a good time. And we get in my friend's truck and we drive somewhere. I'm really rolling hard, so I'm not paying much attention to where we're going, which I should have been. But I remember we're going to a seedy, you know, shady part of Austin. And I'm like, huh, this is weird. I don't know of any strip clubs up here. Of course, I don't know the whole strip club scene that well. And then, so we go in this strip club, and right off the bat, there's a dude with a wand, and then there's a metal detector. I'm like, ooh, this is a red flag. And by the way, we're all three white guys, and we walk into this strip club, and had the DJ been playing vinyl, the shit would have skipped, because it was an all black affair, and it was just so funny. My friends didn't have a clue, and we walked in there, and we were just so fucking out of place, and I just heeled over laughing my ass off, because it was like a butt naked, like, black strip club, where all the, you know, just a black establishment. Now, that's fine, you know, we are not racist at all, and I'm sure those folks wouldn't have minded us staying a bit, but it was just funny because they knew we were out of place, and we knew we were out of place, and it was just so fucking funny. And my two idiot friends were just standing there for a little while, and finally, like, maybe we sat there for like 5 minutes. I was like, you idiots ready to go? And they're like, yeah, let's go. And so we left. I don't know, I thought that, I always get a kick out of that story because it's just so funny. And anyways, also wanted to mention one thing about the podcast. It's that I realized the other day, is the, all the shit, you know, you guys talk about and the Dopey Nation, all the stories and stuff. And it's primarily about IV drug use and heroin addiction. I can't believe nobody's mentioned anything about cotton fever. Dave, I know, have you ever got cotton fever? Dopey Nation, have y'all ever got cotton fever? Let's hear some cotton fever stories, because I got some pretty fucked up ones. I would always get it at the very wrong time. Like the time I did a shot of dope and then went into an AA meeting, and it was the first time I got it. And I started shaking uncontrollably and, like, really, really cold. I was like, oh, man, this must be that cotton fever shit they talk about. And it was really terrible. I had to leave. I can't believe that has never been brought up on the show. So maybe I'll be the first. Who knows? So I love you, Dave. I love you, Dopey Nation. I love the Dopey Nation Facebook group. It's pretty awesome. I'm in it. And stay strong, Dopey Nation. Toodles.
Thank you, Chris. I love this guy, Chris. He, I don't remember his other voicemails, but I always like Chris's voicemails. I love Chris's tone. I love the story. I feel like I've gotten cotton fever, but, like, I don't remember. I can't access my cotton fever story. I love his racially charged techno dancing MDMA story. Send in more stuff. Everybody in the Dopey Nation. Number one, try not to do dope. Try not to die. Try to keep the Dopey Nation strong and alive by staying alive. Number two, try to keep Dopey strong and alive by sending in great voicemails and sending in songs about Dopey, preferably, or about drugs or something funny. You know, I want to hear your songs too, but stuff that gives the show value is really helpful. If you can do a prank phone call, prank a rehab center, prank a wellness community, prank a fucking yoga studio, prank a Kratom store, prank the GNC or whatever the place that sells vitamins, prank your local library, prank. And if you can use Chris's voice from Dopey in the prank, even better. This is a very exciting moment on the show. last week, I had the honor and pleasure of interviewing a drummer from one of the greatest rock and roll bands of all time. I've been flirting with releasing this interview. I'm sure the true Dopey listeners, Dopey Nation, know who I'm talking about. It's fucking Guns N' Roses drummer, fucking celebrity rehab alum, sober house alum, fucking Steven Adler. So buckle yourselves in. It is a long and bumpy interview. Get some popcorn, get some cookies, get some chocolate, get some flavored seltzer, unflavored seltzer, load up the vape, and here is Steven Adler. What's up, everybody? In honor of big honors, we have the fucking...
What?
It's big honors. In honor of big honors, we have a very, 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 very special, special guest, international superstar drummer extraordinaire, Steven fucking Adler. Welcome to the show.
Wow, thank you very much for that greeting.
And how old were you when you met Slash in like junior high school, right?
Yeah, he was 12, I was 13. I'm 6 months and 1 day older than
him. I read your book. I read your book while I was struggling with drug addiction. And,
oh, wow, that's good. That couldn't have helped.
No, it did. I really, really enjoyed your book, My Appetite for Destruction. I loved the book, and I loved hearing about just the beginning of playing. Like, you were the drummer, he was the guitar player, and you guys admired rock and roll bands, right? Who did you love?
Well, my favorite bands was Queen, Kiss, definitely Queen and Kiss, and Journey, love Journey. I love 60s and 70s music.
You love that big rock sound.
Yeah, I love the big rock sound. I love the guitar, the melodic guitar. And back in the 60s and 70s, those drummers learned how to play from drummers that were jazz drummers.
Right.
And the drummers back then, they had like a swing and a groove, right. You know. Once the 80s, everything turned into, you know, the AC/DC beat. The boom, cha, boom, cha, right. Boom, cha. I listened to, you know, Peter Criss, who's a jazz drummer, and Roger Taylor, and Steve Smith from Journey, who's a jazz drummer.
And they were all swingers. They liked to swing.
They're all swingers, dude. I'm a swinger.
And like when you guys started playing, how quickly were you like getting high together? Immediately?
Wait, getting high?
I mean, like smoking weed, whatever. Getting high, beginning. Beginning.
I started smoking weed the first time with my friend Robert James at Winnetka Park. It's over Canoga Park over here in the valley. I was 11, and I found God that day. Every problem I had at home with my stepfather, my little brother, and my mother, it all went away. I never laughed so hard. I laughed so hard for so long that we went to the Taco Bell that was across the street, and I couldn't order my bell beefer with no onions and taco, no cheese, okay, because I was laughing so hard. Me, when I met Slash, the first time he smoked pot, I wasn't with him, but when he did, he got paranoid and freaked out. So he enjoyed drinking alcohol, and I enjoyed drinking or smoking pot. And so he never drank, you know, never smoked pot. So it was really he would drink, and I would take a sip off here and there. Or my grandfather had a bottle of Wild Turkey that when he would come home from the bakery early in the morning, he would do a shot before he'd go to bed. And, you know, when we'd come over, we would ditch school and we'd go to my grandma's house. And we'd do, you know, a shot of Wild Turkey and then pour a little water in there, you know, to make it like...
So your grandpa didn't notice. Right.
Yeah, now that I'm an alcoholic, I mean, not practicing, thank God, right now, but having been one, I'm going like, it's totally obvious that you knew we were drinking off and putting water in.
Right.
You cannot take it. That taste is so disgusting. You know it.
But did your grandpa ever, did your grandpa never said anything to you about it? He didn't know it was you.
No, he just would never say anything.
Do you think he knew it was you and Saul?
No, my grandparents, I'm so thankful that when my mom and my stepfather kicked me out, that I got to live with my grandparents. See, I left the hospital when I was born, and I lived with my grandparents for the first 5 years. And then I moved out to L.A. when I was 7, and my stepfather came. And then when I was 11, when I was 12, I moved to Hollywood with my grandmother, because my stepfather and my mom, my stepdad just didn't want me around. And it was the best thing that ever happened, was that one day I came home from school and all my clothes and stuff were on the sidewalk, and my grandparents came driving down the street to pick me up. It was probably the beginning of my whole entire amazing life. Because like a week or so after that, I met Slash and said, look what all the amazing things we did. I couldn't have asked for a nicer, cooler, more talented, funnier, most loving best friend to grow up with. You know, and that's one thing. I know that was then, and we're older now, and he has kids. I have 3 kids, but they're dogs.
Yes.
You know, but you know, I wish I would have been I thought we were going to be like Geddy Lee and Alex Lyson.
They
met each other in junior high school. They started playing music together, and they put a band together. They've been together for 45 years. And, you know, so I always thought that was going to be me and Slash.
Well, but on the upside is you made better music than Rush. So even...
I'm just saying. I don't know about that.
Dude, trust me.
Alex Lyson is the greatest guitar player ever. Okay? The shit he came up with, those riffs, those songs rule. But then again, Slash and Izzy came up with some magic.
I can do without Rush, and I'm a huge fan of Guns N' Roses, and I love you. And I know one thing.
Thank you.
You know, I never met you. I spoke to you on the phone a couple of times. And I wasn't a metal guy when I was a kid. You know, I loved rock and roll. Yeah. And I really thought that what Guns N' Roses had, it's like we were, it was a point in that mid-80s, and there was this terrible barrage of this hair metal and these power ballads and just like, you know, solos with too many notes for the sake of too many notes. And then all of a sudden, Guns N' Roses appeared. You guys looked a little like that, but it didn't sound like that. It sounded like rock and roll, and it pushed forward, and it was all about the swing of the drums and the way the guitar drove the music. You know, it was like the two of you, and I watched it, and I always thought, I looked at Izzy Stradlin when I watched it, and I was like, this dude does not look like everybody else. There was just something about him that I was like, I just thought he was the coolest thing when I was a kid.
He is. Izzy is the coolest guy. Besides Steven Tyler and my bass player right now, Tanya O'Callaghan, Izzy is the coolest person I ever met in my life.
Now, when you met Slash, were you already a drummer?
I actually wanted to be a singer, but I could barely learn the English language. So the singing, as you can hear me talk to you right now, was just not going to work.
Can you sing?
And then I started listening to Queen. I got into Kiss Alive 1 and 2 and Queen Live Killers. And I was all, holy shit, that feel of the drums that it just that gave me was just, I was like, it was like the euphoria.
But here's a question, Stephen.
How do they do that? They're taking shit. Like, I would hang out at this club I was like 13, 14, 15, and I called the Starwood.
Right.
It was on Crescent Heights in Santa Monica. And I would see, you know, I saw Nikki Sixx. He was the first person I ever saw on stage at a little club. And he is the reason I said, I want to do this. I saw Kiss in 77 at Magic Mountain. before I saw Nikki. But seeing Kiss, it was just so huge.
Right.
And they looked like they were 20 feet tall, and it was just such a huge show. That's what, you know, 11, 12-year-old kid, it was like, that's just unreachable. And then, like, a year later, I would hang out at this club. Or one night, me and Sash were walking by the club, Starwood, and we heard this music, and we go, dude, let's go check this out. And we went over, and we looked inside the VIP door, which was a VIP curtain. And the first person I saw on stage was Nikki Sixx. I didn't know it was Nikki Sixx. I just saw this guy. He looked like he was 12 feet tall, with his hair a foot up in the air, in black leather, with a black and white striped bass. I don't remember any of what the other guys looked like. I just remember him because he had this glow about him, this energy that was like, holy shit. He made it a club. I was like, wow, maybe it is possible, you know, to become a huge rock star.
But Steven, when you saw Nikki Sixx, he wasn't even a huge rock star at the time. He just had that aura.
There was a band called London.
Right.
And he just, like, this energy work, he glowed.
Right.
And it was awesome. And the drummer, they were those North drum sets. You know, they're like macaroni shaped, kind of.
I don't know what you're talking about, but I'm with you.
Nikki Sixx and a North drum set. I thought, hey, I had a guitar, and within a week, he was going, you know, from one chord to another to another to another. Within like a week or two, he was actually playing, you know, a whole song.
And you were starting to drum.
And then I started playing the drums, but, you know, playing drums in an apartment is different. So I played on my grandfather's books, and I used those, you know, those suit coat hangers. They got that little wooden stick in it.
Right.
Those were my first drumsticks. That and I worked with like my grandma's Tupperware.
And you just had the knack, though, for it. You had a natural rhythm,
I didn't have a natural rhythm. I just loved it, and I like when I said when I would go hang out at the Starwood, I would watch these other drummers play. Like the biggest influence growing up that I got to learn from was Leonard Hayes from YNT. Just, they were back in the 70s, they were called Yesterday and Today. And I would be able to sit on the stairs that went up to the dressing room, and I could look right down, and I could watch him play. And I was like, he's taking these two sticks, and he does this with his foot, and he hits this thing, and hits that thing. And it just sounded and felt so amazing. I was all, I have to be a part of that. So I learned from watching drummers play. But Leonard Hayes was like the first drummer that I watched, and I was all, okay, he did that to do that sound. He did this. And I just took off from there. I had one lesson. I had the guy at the music store that I bought my drums at, my first drum set. I said, show me how to play Over the Mountain from Ozzy.
Right.
And it's basically 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, just faster. So I said, if I could do that, I could play anything.
And that was the beginning of everything.
And that was the beginning. And it's been amazing, crazy, fucked up, fun, exciting, unexpected, beautiful experience.
And when you finally, I mean, when you were playing with Slash, how much drugs and alcohol were involved as teenagers? Like, how high would you get? How drunk would you get? Was that a big part of it?
It wasn't. It was never. I never seen Slash throw up or pass out. I mean, growing up, but when the band started happening, he would piss the bed. He would get so shit faced. He would piss his pants. Which blew my mind that you get that fucked up. But back in the day when we were kids, I never seen him even throw up. He had that guitar consistently. Everywhere we went, he always had his acoustic guitar and was playing.
He was disciplined.
Down Sunset Boulevard, and he'd be have his guitar.
You know what, Steven? Fucking many years ago, I was a heroin addict, and I was making a TV show, and I actually got I interviewed Slash at Wetlands in Manhattan when he was touring with Slash's Snake Pit, and I was all high, and I didn't mention that I was all high. I don't know if he was high then. Was he?
Yeah, he was. Of course he was.
I interviewed a lot of people back then. He was high then. And so when because I know you guys started a couple bands, the bands broke up, you joined this Hollywood Rose, and you brought together Axel, Duff, Izzy, and Slash, and you.
Yes. And we played together with a couple different people. We just did everything we could to get as much experience as we could. And then at the right time, at the right moment, everything just fell right into place. And it was easy from rehearsal one.
Well, that's the question.
Rehearsal one, there was no effort made.
You played.
It was just magic.
You played in a ton of bands. The second that lineup was together, was it totally different? It was just obvious?
It was obvious from the first note. It was just from the first note, and we finished the first song, we all looked at each other, and we were all, this is it. So, all just had that look in our eye, like, yeah, this is what I've been wanting.
So would you say to somebody out there who's playing in a shitty band, if it doesn't sound that good, it's probably not going to happen immediately?
No, I think practice and repetition makes the master, and play with everybody you possibly can.
Right.
The more experience you get playing with other people, the more people you play with, the sooner you're going to find the right people to play with.
When did the drugs infiltrate the band? Did you guys have did you have the songs before the drugs? What happened first?
Oh, no, the drugs were always going on. I would drink a little bit, like if we went out to the Rainbow or a club. You know, I would drink, but I just smoked weed. And if somebody had a line of blow, I would do a line. But I wasn't spending my money on drugs. You know, the only thing I would spend it on would probably be $10-$20 on a bag of weed. But it was usually, you know, some friend had some weed. That's all I did. I didn't get into the heroin until the last day of the Aerosmith tour. That's when I liked it. I did it, and I liked it.
Who did you do it with? What was the story?
And Steven Tyler. I went into the meet and greet room where all these people were. Steven Tyler, who I love and adore more than anything, was talking with these girls, and he was getting them. He's so funny. They were laughing their asses off. And Steven had his big smile, laughing. And I was standing at the doorway, you know, this rock star, my arm on the door, you know, trying to look cool. And he looked up when he was laughing. He looked up and he saw me. And that smile turned into a frown. And he took one look at me, and he instantly knew that the look of you are on heroin.
But where did you get
it
from?
It just broke my heart.
What was the story?
I heard... What's that?
Where did you get it? What was the situation that you wound up doing dope on the tour?
This old bass player friend of mine, I was riding my scooter around, and this old bass player friend of mine was up by where the trucks, you know, come in, up by the fence where the big trucks come to unload the gear. And I had this little skateboard scooter. And I saw him up there, so I went up there, and I said, dude, do you have any passes and tickets? And he's all, no. And I used to wear that little fanny pack, you know, I was hip in the 80s.
Yes.
And I pulled out a couple of tickets and passes. I said, dude, come to the show tonight. And then I said, what are you doing now? And he said, well, I'm going to score some heroin. And I don't know why. I can't tell you why, because I don't know myself. But I pulled out like $60 and said, here, give me some too. And I did it after the show, and I liked it.
The first time you did it, did you snort it? You snorted it the first time?
I smoked it.
Okay.
I smoked it on the foil.
Yeah.
Because Izzy, I smoked it twice before. Izzy showed me how to smoke it on the foil. Because him and Sass were shooting it up, and there was no way in hell I was putting a needle in my arm back then.
Right.
That's fucking insane. So he said, well, you can smoke it. So I took like one hit, and I was sick for at least 10 hours. I sat in his tiny little bathroom in this little, you know, what do they call it? Bachelor pad fucking apartment above Hollywood Boulevard. So sick. And then the second time I did it was at Bob Welch's house. And I don't know why. It's like I forgot completely about the first time. And I got so sick again. And then this one time I said, what are you doing to my friend? And he goes, I'm going to get heroin. I don't know why. But I said, go get me some too.
Well, that's funny because it's like third time's the charm. I remember the first time I did it, I got super sick too.
The third time I was like, yeah, okay, now I get it.
Right.
That warm feeling in your stomach, that mellow feeling laid back. I'm like, okay, I get it. But I fucking broke Steven Tyler's heart, and that broke my heart. And I finally got to tell him that story like about 3 years ago at this AA meeting, and I told him. And he was I totally remember that.
Right.
I was so heartbroken. I said, I know, I saw the look on your face. It broke my heart that I broke your heart.
Because he was this hero.
He was going to give me as a gift that the outfit he wore in the video, Angel,
yes.
He would wear that. He had that white, you know, one piece.
Yes.
He was going to give that to me as a gift. And because when he saw me like that on the heroin, I never got that as a gift.
Because of the heroin,
arm.
Even though he was the worst junkie in the history of junkies.
He was worried to death about me. He looked at me like with such fear and just worry. I was like, oh my God, my heart just sank into the pit of my stomach. I was like, I just broke Steven Tyler's heart. I don't know what I did, but I did. But look on his face.
Well, he saw a young version of himself making the same mistake,
yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
How long had Slash and Izzy been doing dope at that point?
Oh, God. This is how naive I am. Slash has been doing drugs, hard drugs, since we were at least 13 years old. I had no fucking clue that he's already done heroin, that he's already done crack. It was freebase that day. I had no idea that he was taking pills. All I did was, you know, I had a couple of, you know, drinks of whiskey, a few beers, I smoked
right.
weed.
Right.
You know, I had no idea to years, like decades later, that he was doing all this shit. Put it this way, I spent the night in his house, and I thought we were sleeping in the same bed together because his little brother, Albion, or Ash was sleeping in his bed. So the whole night that I'm thinking of Sasha and I are sleeping, you know, in the same room or in the same bed, he was downstairs partying with his mom's boyfriend, but which she didn't know, of course. But he was down there partying, smoking crack. Dude, I had tunnel vision.
Right.
All I saw was practice, pay your dues. Practice, 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 pay your dues. Play with everybody you can. Success. You want your dream, your goal, that being to put a band together that makes music just like the music that these bands that you love, that make you feel so good, just like. So I had total tunnel vision. I just was, my eyes were on the prize.
But the time, that third time you did dope and you were like, this is good,
yeah,
what happened then?
I just broke Steven Tyler's heart. And then I didn't do it again for probably another year or so.
Right.
I didn't go right back to it. It was all, dude, there were times where I had so much cocaine that I was all, I don't even want this anymore. And I would just give it to my tour manager. I would say, here, I don't even want this. That's enough.
Right. So when did that change?
You know?
When did it start to run you?
They started to run me when they kicked me out of the band.
It wasn't until they kicked you out of the band that it ran you.
But, oh, yeah. See, but, I was partying with Slash. We were doing the heroin thing up at his house in Low Canyon. And we did it for like 2-3 months. And I didn't know that when you do heroin and then you stop doing it, that you get violently sick.
Right.
So after like about, 6-7 weeks of, bringing up money from the ATM and getting a little piece of heroin and him getting a big piece, because I didn't know. I'd pay for it, and he would get this big piece and give me a little tiny piece, but I didn't know the difference. But after like 6-7 weeks of that, I was like, dude, this is boring. All we do is fucking lay around like zombies. And so I went back home, and then I got violently sick. And I called my manager up, my tour manager, and I said, dude, Doug, I feel like I'm dying. I'm going to die, dude. Please, I need help. So he picked me up. He took me to a doctor. And the doctor, who had to have known, because he's a doctor, that if you take an opiate blocker and have opiates in your system, that you're going to get even more violent.
Well, why were you taking the opiate blocker at that point?
Well, no, I called him up, my tour manager. I said, I'm really sick. I don't understand it. He took me to the doctor. I said I was doing heroin.
Right.
And the doctor, he gave me an opiate blocker while I had it in my system.
Oh.
So the doctor had to have known, because he's a doctor, that you don't take an opiate blocker while you have opiates in your system.
No, you get really sick.
Or you get violently sick.
Yeah.
So I'm like so sick. Like, I mean, if I could go to the bathroom, I was crawling on the floor. And then Slash calls me up and says, dude, we're going in to record Civil War this weekend, which was like in 2 days. And I'll go, dude, I'm so sick. Please, can't we just wait 1 week till we can do it? And he goes, oh, dude, we can't waste the money. And I said, hey, dude, both of us know somebody who's wasted a hell of a lot of money, a lot more money on other bullshit. I said, you can't wait. It's 1 week. I'm so sick. So they're all, no. So I had to go in. We went to record Civil War at A&M Records. And usually every track that we've ever recorded was either the first, second, maybe third, or a fourth take.
Right.
I went in to do Civil War. I was so weak and I was so sick that it took me like 25 fucking times. And he kept saying, dude, you're just fucked up. And I was saying, I'm not. I'm sick. And I was telling my tour manager to tell these guys, and he wouldn't fucking tell them. So that's when I realized, well, I didn't realize then, I realized later on that they planned this whole thing out. Because the next day they had me go down to the office and sign these contracts. They just said one thing, but it was really taking everything, all my royalties, all my rights, everything away from me. Basically, they're going to give me $2,000 and throw me out on the street like I never existed. And we have already sold like fucking 15 million records.
Well, Steven, I have a lot of questions. But the first question is, if Izzy and Slash and Duff was on heroin too, right?
No, Duff was the coke and vodka guy.
And Axel, guy. Axel was just in, Axel was
Axel
just insane.
Did everything.
Oh, he did everything.
Axel did everything.
So why were you the one that was scapegoated when everybody had a problem?
I think because everybody was so fucked up, and everybody at that point had their own little circle of friends that weren't in the band, but were like their drug dealers and their yes men.
Right.
You know? Yes,
well, did you have a crew of yes men?
No, I just had my couple friends. We just hung out.
I
hung out with the road crew. I love those guys.
When you
road
guys
were the greatest.
When you were recording Appetite and you were putting down those songs, you know, like Welcome to the Jungle and Sweet Child of Mine and Paradise City and all these songs, were you high then?
Like, was I stoned?
I'm just, what were you on? Like, what was the deal? Like, was,
oh, I'm pretty sure I was smoking a little weed, yeah.
And was Slash and them on dope for that stuff?
I'm sure they all were, because they were all doing it back then.
And when you guys were making those records, was it like the greatest feeling in the world?
we would play the song, and we would go into the boardroom, and he would play it back, and we would just look at each other and go, this is going to be fucking huge. This is going to be so huge. Everything that we dreamed about since we were teenagers has actually come to life, and we're listening to it. We're so happy. It was a band. Back then, the saying was, dude, doing it for the band. It's for the band.
Right.
And then it became, oh, it's for me. It's for me.
Well, I also read that, like, there was at some point, there was some American Music Award show, and you were in detox. So, like, you were
talking. I was in a fucking rehab, and Glenn Frey came. Oh, no,
Don Henley.
Don Henley came in, and so then that was the beginning
right.
of the heartbreak.
And at what point did you tour with the Stones?
Oh, God, that was 88, I think. And we did tour with them. We just did 2 weekends. At the Coliseum here in L.A. Actually, 3 months ago, I had dinner with Mick Jagger and Eric Clapton and Al Pacino. And Mick and I, we were talking about that show because Axel went out there and said, you know, I'm never playing with these guys again. They're all fucked up on heroin. And then 3 songs later, he falls off the stage. And Mick Jagger thought that was the fucking craziest, greatest thing. He said, I can't believe that GNR is leaving you and Izzy out of the band. Even Keith isn't that much of a wanker and an idiot to not use the whole original band. Okay? That's what it was from Mick's words.
Can you do a little English accent, or is that as close as it's going to get?
No, dude, I can't even speak English. If you understand, I talk on my phone, you know, when you text. You could talk on it for texting.
Yeah.
You know what shows up? Question marks.
Is that right? That's funny.
A line of question marks. What the fuck did you just say?
I have more questions, though. Did you write the song Paradise City?
Axel wrote All the World. And the four of us, Slash and Duff and Izzy and myself, wrote all the music.
Okay, so you have a co-write on all those songs.
Oh, yeah. Well, most of the songs, if you notice, they start off with a distinct drum beat that stands out.
Right.
Okay, well, that's how a lot of those songs came together, was I would be in rehearsal, and I would do these drum beats, and they would start playing with me. And then next thing you know, we had a song. It was just so magical. Even our worst shows that we played together were fucking amazing. Five guys with five different personalities, five different musical tastes, but when we got together, we had the same goal and the same dream.
Here's another question. You're a student of rock and roll history, correct?
Yes, I'm a fan of it, yes.
What, is there a band that was a bigger junkie band than you guys? Can you think of one? Who, the Heartbreakers, maybe, with Johnny Thunders. Who else?
Believe me, there's a lot of other bands doing shit you just don't know about. They're better secret keepers than we were.
Well, they right.
And kind of worked for our being the most dangerous band in the world. You know, being junkies, it just kind of worked for us. But trust me, there's bands that I party with that were like, holy shit, you guys are nuts. You got to go, dude, Motley Crue. I don't know how they got on stage. Those guys partied so hard. The first night we played with Motley Crue, we toured with them. First night, I got off stage, and Tommy's all, dude, come here, Stevie. Come here, I got something to show you. Come here. And he takes me in one of these rooms, and it's got one of those, like, 6-foot-long tables, you know, where the legs unfold. And there's 2 lines of cocaine on it. And he goes, you start that end, I'll start this end. And we met in the middle. And he goes, oh, shit, I got to fucking go play in 10 minutes. I can't believe it. And we finished the line, and he went out there and killed it. It's so funny, like Sash and Izzy and Dove and Axel, like back in the day, they kicked me out of the day because I was doing drugs. That's fucking hilarious. That's like calling the kettle black. I was doing drugs with you.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's a crazy story. And after they kicked you,
after they, bad guy.
But after they kicked you out of the band, that's where the fucking addiction really took hold, right?
Oh yeah, well, because I was heartbroken. I found out later on in my years that I had abandonment issues. You know, like my real father left before I was born, and then with my stepfather, you know, throwing me out of the house, and then my band, who I thought had my back and that loved me, and they did that to me.
Yeah, it's terrible, but so, but somehow you forgave them, you know. But
yeah,
how long? How long?
20 years, but it took me 20 years to learn about, you know, not having resentment. And because that was what kept me drinking and doing drugs, was this resentment I had towards them. When I really, I should have been, you know, instead of wasting, you know, my energy on this resentment and hurt and killing myself slowly, I should have gotten my act together. See, there was two ways to go: either get your act together, clean up, or go off the deep end. I mean, because, you know, I had to go to court, you know, I had to sue them for that contract damage. So I had to see them in court. And it's like, how did you do this to me? Especially Slash.
What would,
you know,
he say?
So it was heartbreaking.
What would he say?
So, dude, I went off. I tried to kill myself, you know, and doing drugs was, you know, sort of, you know, numbing the pain for, you know, hours at a time.
But when you confronted Slash, what did he say?
He said, "I'm sorry, I was fucked up." This is when I was able to finally confront him. Dr. Drew got him together with me, and he had already been sober for about 3-4 years. And he said, "I'm just so sorry about that. You know, I was just getting so high. I didn't realize what was going on," and he apologized. And it's so funny how a sincere apology could make heartache go away.
Right, because it was
words
from the heart.
Words are so powerful. Words are so powerful.
Right.
"You're a scumbag. That's going to break my heart. I love you. I'm really sorry about what happened." And it made it go away. And it's like, I got my friend back.
Right. What was the ultimate bottom for you through all that stuff? Like, what was the final straw for you?
With what? The drugs?
Yeah.
Well, you know, they came out with cell phones that have videos on them. And my wife was videotaping me getting fucked up and getting drunk. Because, you know, I would get drunk, you know, from 6 in the morning. I would drink to 6 in the morning to 6 in the morning. And she would tell me the next day, you know, "Oh, you did this and you acted like that and you did that." And I would say, I did not. And then she fucking videotaped me. And videotape doesn't lie. And I saw myself the way I was acting. And I was all, I got to change. I don't want to do this. I can't believe the things I'm saying, the things I'm doing.
So when you saw yourself, that was the change.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It is such a pleasure to wake up in the morning and not come to and not have to apologize or feel guilty or be ashamed of anything I did the day before. This way, I see the sun come up every morning. I wake up early, and I have nothing to apologize, nothing to make amends for, nothing to feel guilty about. And I go, "It's a beautiful day."
Absolutely.
What crazy, cool thing am I going to, fun thing am I going to do today? I was so tired. But the real, even after all that, I went into the Slash and my good brother, my great friend Jeff Tilson, got me into this psycho hospital, and I stayed there for a month. And the second I got out, I went straight to the bar and started doing shots of Jaeger. And I had to wait like 2 days to get out, to get a flight out. So basically, the hotel I was at, I was just drinking every day. And then once I got my flight, I got home. I had the cab take me right to the liquor store. I got more booze. And the next morning, I continued doing what I was doing before I went into the mental hospital, which was up at 6 in the morning, because that's when the liquor store opens, and walking to the liquor store. I did that the next day. And the next day, I did it again. And I don't know what or how or what it was or why, but I would walk. I opened the front door to walk out to go to the liquor store at 6 in the morning again, and something just came into my head that was, I guess they call it a spiritual awakening, where the voice that always that had control over, yes, we're going to drink, yes, we're going to party, yes, I don't even know why they call it partying.
I know.
You just get sick. You just get sick. Yes, yes, you know, that voice that was in my head that I couldn't shut up. I was walking out my door, and some bigger, stronger voice in my head said, I can't do this anymore. I'm not doing this anymore. And I went and I woke my wife up, and I said, take me to an AA meeting. And I went to an AA meeting. And it's been 4.5 years. And within 4.5 years, I feel that if you're going to, you know, be a part of recovery, you have to be completely honest with yourself. And of course, with others. Like when I go to meetings, I tell the truth. So it's been 4.5 years since I had that spiritual awakening. And yes, I am not perfect. Yes, I do enjoy smoking a little pot. I do. I dig it. At nighttime when the day's over, I like to, I love my dogs. I watch Family Guy, and I like to smoke a little weed.
Here's the question, though.
But within 4.5 years, 4.5 years, over 2,000 days, there has been four separate occasions, not four binges, but four separate times where I did have a drink. I did take a shot of Jack Daniels one time. Then at one time, I took a shot of fucking Jaeger.
Why? What was the situation?
I couldn't tell you. I just know that I felt like I just needed a drink. I did it, and I realized how shitty I felt after it. And I went to my sponsor, and I told them, and he said, don't beat yourself up. It's a brand new day. Let's start fresh.
Stephen, when...
So, but there have been.
When was the last time you did heroin?
Oh, God. That was when I got arrested on a celebrity rehab.
Oh, yeah?
It's fuckers. Can you believe that? I'm doing a show about being a drug addict and doing drugs, and they got me arrested because they brought drugs with me.
It's just like getting kicked out of a junkie band for being a junkie. It's total bullshit. It's total bullshit.
It was bullshit. It was just for drama.
Well, it was good drama.
Now, when's the last time Dr. Drew helped me get off the crack? Helped me get off the heroin? I kept that problem with the alcohol, and I right now, like I said, I'm honest. I have to be honest. Because you lie, the more the lies build up, and the shittier you feel, and then you feel like crap, and you probably end up doing something that you're gonna, you know, I'll regret.
Of course,
so I have to keep it honest. Nobody is expected to do this program perfectly. None of us are saints,
right?
I got kicked out of an AA meeting last week because I mentioned that, and I said that, and about being honest, and dude, I got thrown out of an AA meeting sober. How the hell did you get kicked out of an AA meeting sober? Only I could do that.
What happened exactly?
You give me a microphone, and I'm always an honest person.
Well, what happened? Wait, why?
You know, and I say what's on my mind.
So tell me exactly what happened.
Like what I had to say.
What did you say exactly?
Didn't like what I had to say.
What did you say?
I have no idea, but it wasn't. They didn't appreciate it. That's all.
Who asked you to leave?
Well, one guy stood up and said, okay, that's enough. And I wanted to stand up and push him back down in his chair and say, fuck you. I didn't interrupt you when you were fucking sharing. Don't interrupt me. But I just said, okay, I can dig it. And that was it. I left.
Steven, does that happen?
I went out. I had a cigar. I just said something that people didn't. That, I guess, touched the nerve.
In L.A.?
How would you say it?
You pushed one of his buttons.
I put somebody on the spot. I said, you said this and that. And I gave my opinion. And that person didn't like my opinion. And got angry. And stood up. And instead of me, you know, jumping on him and pushing him down and telling him to fuck off, I said, okay, I'm going to go outside. And I left. I had a cigar. Then the meeting was over. I came back in. I said, I'm really sorry, guys. I didn't mean to, you know, upset anybody. And they said, we love you. And I went on. And then I went home with Jeff, my friend Jeff Tilson. He took me.
In Los Angeles, are there a lot of confrontations during meetings? Because that doesn't happen in New York. I've never seen anybody get kicked out.
But you see, addicts are very judgmental people. And see, when I be honest, and somebody isn't honest, and I call somebody else on it, they take it personal, and they jumped on me. You know? And it's just, you know, people, the one thing I love about AA meetings is whenever I go, except for the last one, obviously, is I always leave feeling like $1 million because I hear these people share and I go, Jesus, my life is so awesome, compared to what these people are talking about going through. I got nothing to complain about. So I love going there because it always makes me feel great. But there's so many judgmental people. Like 99% of AA people that I say, that I tell, I still enjoy smoking a pot. They say, dude, you used to drink from 6 in the morning. You used to shoot heroin. You used to shoot cocaine. Okay? You want to smoke a little pot at night? Smoke a little pot. There's always that 1% that go, well, no, that's not, you know, you're not supposed to do that. That's not, you know, that's not cool. I said, dude, you got your opinion. Thank God opinions are like assholes. Everybody's got one. I'm not going to take it personal.
Did you ever try to not smoke weed? Did you try to, like, not do anything? Like, what made you smoke weed in the first place?
Yeah, I did.
And what was the thing?
Of course I did. It made me feel good. Like I said, when the beginning of this interview, when Slash first smoked pot, he got all weird and paranoid, like some people do. First time I smoked it, I found fucking God. I was like, this is great. And I can still function and do stuff. But I usually just smoke at night. And, you know, with my dogs. My dogs love to smoke weed. They seal a joint in their mouth. It's so cute. No, I'm kidding.
When I was relapsing the last time, right, and I was just smoking weed and I was taking pills and stuff, my co-host, the guy who just died, would always say to me, he would say, if you can smoke weed and not do heroin, that's fine. But the second you find yourself doing something else, you're going to know you can't smoke weed, you know?
Yeah.
And it sounds like you've got your shit together with this thing, you know? Like, I can't judge you. I just know that, like, for me, like, I'm happy being totally sober. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not judging you. For me, I like being totally sober, you know? Like,
hey, this is the most sober I've been in 30 years, and I'm happier than I've ever been in 30 years.
Right, I can't judge you. You know what I mean? Like, or I could judge you, but what's the fucking point? It's all about happiness and quality of life.
God, they say, if you want to talk about judgment, God's not judging nobody. If God ain't judging anybody, who are you to judge?
Right.
I mean, if I tell you, you know, you're this and you're doing that and you're doing this, and I'm doing worse, or the same thing, yeah, of course you could judge me. Or sick, compared to everything that I've done in my life and to myself.
Would you tell the overdose story?
Okay, well, I'm sitting on, I live in Century City in my condo, and I was sitting on the toilet, and I shot up too much cocaine too fast. I pushed the plunger in too fast, so the heroin or the cocaine, you know, just put me in a seizure, and I fell on the floor, and I started smashing my face on the tile, on the floor, and I knocked a couple of teeth out. I cut open my chin. I broke the bone in my chin and had a mild stroke.
Jesus
and
Christ.
And then when I got to the hospital, I died. I went to a place called they call heaven, even though heaven is in your brain, is in your mind and your heart and soul, where it was the most beautiful place I ever been. I remember floating above my bed, looking down at myself, and then I went to another place, and it was the most beautiful place that had the most beautiful colors that they don't have on this planet. And this lady said to me, "It's not time." And I was floating above myself again, and next thing you know, I woke up.
Wow.
And then it was like 4 or 5, 6 hours later.
Wow. That's crazy. How many times do you think you overdosed?
Twice.
What was the other one?
The other one was we were working on that Clint Eastwood movie, The Deadpool.
Yeah.
And if you watch the movie, we're after Jim Carrey ODs, where we're talking about ODing. Jim Carrey, and he plays this rock singer, and he ODs, and we're at the funeral. So you see us at the funeral, and then the next scene that you see us, you only see Slash and Duff and Izzy. And Slash shoots his harpoon through this door, this window, and this door of a boat. And the reason I'm not there and Axel's not there was because after we did the first day of shooting, I met some stripper, and she poured this brown powder stuff in my beer. And the next thing I knew, I woke up in a hospital. Axel was holding my hand, and I had charcoal coming out of every hole in my body. And like I said, Axel was there crying.
Well, what was the charcoal there for?
The charcoal, they pump you full of charcoal, and it sucks up all the poison.
Wow.
You know, all the drugs and everything. So you're shitting and throwing up and blowing your nose of nothing but charcoal.
Now I know this is going on forever.
And because of that one thing, that Axel was there for me, I will always love him, and he will always have my support.
Well, here's the question,
Steven. I mean, even though he threw me under the bus, you know, on this whole reunion thing, which isn't a reunion thing, I will always love him for him holding my hand and me coming to him and seeing him crying, saying, "Please don't die, Steven. Please don't die." And I would go, I'm not dying. And he woke up, and he was so happy, and he hugged me. And for that, he will always be a huge part of my heart. That and what the five of us accomplished, our dream, and what we did, that I'm so proud of all of us for, you know, doing what we did. And I'm so proud of being able to know those guys and work with them. And it was only a 5-year run, but it was better than nothing.
No, it's way. You made history.
5 years, greatest 5 years of my life, and I've known Slash for 40 years, and I'm so thankful that Slash is still my friend.
Well, here's another
after
question.
40 years,
real quick. You know, they got back together to do this. What was the tour called?
Not in this lifetime.
Right, not in this lifetime. And
they were correct. And it's correct. not in this lifetime, will there be a real Gene Harvey unit.
Right. So they're touring without you and without Izzy.
Izzy, yeah. So basically, it's Axl Rose featuring Slash and Duff.
So when you show up to do, you showed up in Rio, you showed up at Dodger Stadium, and I saw it, and the crowd went insane when you played, and it must have felt amazing to be in the spot, but did it also feel sad? What were you going through in those moments?
The before and after were the sad parts, because I was watching Frank, who was a great guy, an amazing drummer, play my songs wrong.
Right.
Not even close. And it was very, but the playing part, to be able to look down and see Duff and Axl and Slash, you know, Richard, he kind of looks like Izzy. So from a distance,
right,
I was just, you know, dreaming and fantasizing that was Izzy. I would love to do more of it with him. I would love to play more songs.
When Duff gets on the riser in front of you and starts playing it like that, why does he do that? Why does he stand up on the riser? Because he misses you?
No, because we're rocking out together, and that's what rock brothers do.
There it is. Now, when you show up at these things, did you talk to Axl?
Yes, I did. I gave him a hug. I shook his hand. I said, that was the greatest thing. I love you very much. Greatest thing fucking ever. Thank you so much for letting me be a part of that.
And what does he say?
Nothing. He grinned at me and walked away with his partner or whoever he was with.
And is he sober? I know Slash is sober and Duff is sober.
Yeah, I have no idea. I have no idea what they do, where they go, who they talk to. I am not a part of their life.
Well, here's another question.
So I really have no idea. I don't even know what Slash is doing. I mean, I heard he's playing some shows with Slash's band. But I don't know nothing. Unfortunately, I'm not allowed to be a part of their lives, or they don't want me to be a part of their lives. So
why?
I don't know, but I just have to accept it and keep living.
And why?
That's what I will do.
I mean, Slash, laughing. When Slash did his last solo record, he had you play on it, right?
Yeah, but it's just a shame. It's because I just got out of rehab that didn't work.
Right.
And I was still under medication, so I did a really crappy job. So I don't even know if that's really me.
Right.
Or if they just cut pieces that I did good in.
Right.
But I was very, you know, I was just happy that I was doing something with Slash, and especially Flea, because, you know, Flea was there. And me and Slash and Flea, we all went to junior high school, grew up together.
Right. That's so crazy.
I just wish that I was mentally and physically in better shape at that time.
Right. What did you ever think about asking Izzy to start a band?
I've asked Izzy to come and play some shows with me a couple times. Izzy is happy being Izzy. And Izzy has a talent for living. Okay?
But he doesn't play, right?
He plays, you know, he does whatever he wants to do when he wants to do it. He wants to record a song, write a song, he does it. He lives his life on his terms, and I idolize him. I wish I could be more like him.
Where does he live?
More free-spirited.
Where does he live?
I don't know.
There it is.
He's a traveling man.
Well,
he buys cars. He buys old cars and vans and trucks and fixes them up and just drives across country.
You should sit him down for a jam, and I really appreciate you talking to me for so long and sharing so much of this adventure you've had. And you're an amazing, amazing musician, amazing guy, and so sweet, and I appreciate it. Real quick, do you like the Beatles or the Stones?
I love them both.
Simpsons or Family Guy?
Family Guy.
Michael Jackson or Prince?
God, I know Prince plays it all. That's a tough one. Prince.
Mick or Keith?
What?
Mick or Keith?
Oh, Mick, of course.
Chocolate chip cookie or black and white?
What's that?
Chocolate chip or black and white?
Black and white.
Carole King or Carly Simon?
Oh my God, Carole King, the goddess.
Xanax or Klonopin?
Xanax. Xanax.
Suboxone.
Huh? Xanax. I want a Mexican Quaalude. God damn it!
Fucking, you want to go for the old the Mandrakes? Fucking Suboxone or Methadone?
Oh, that's Suboxone. Suboxone,
because
Methadone's a fucking bitch to get off of.
Yeah, I got off that shit.
Oh, my God. That was 100 times worse than heroin.
Smoking weed or vaping weed?
Smoking weed, baby. Smoking token.
Nirvana or
I'm a
Pearl Jam? Smoking
token, a midnight joker.
Yeah, you're not a vapor and a.
I'm loving on the run.
Nirvana or Pearl Jam?
Nirvana, all the way. I personally think Kurt Cobain was Jimi Hendrix reincarnated.
You really think that?
Dude, listen to his playing. Listen to the sounds that he made out of that guitar. He was left-handed. He sang with lyrics that nobody else could come up with.
But he couldn't play. He couldn't play. He was a songwriter.
I first fell in love with Nirvana when I heard it. I don't know the name of the song, but he says, Kurt Cobain goes, "You're so ugly, but that's okay because I'm ugly too." And I said, "This guy's a fucking genius," and I fell in love with him.
You think he's
and
more?
You listen to the sounds he makes.
You think he's incredible. More? He's more Jimi Hendrix than John Lennon, though.
Oh yeah. Oh, Jimi Hendrix. Dude, listen to those sounds he makes on the guitar. The way he uses the whammy bar.
That's true.
And shakes his guitar. He was probably the best guitar players. Of the 90s.
All right, we're back in my questions. Hold on. John or Paul?
Wait, what?
John or Paul?
Oh, John. I have to say John.
Acid or mushrooms?
Mushrooms.
Biggie or Tupac?
Neither.
Spaghetti or penne?
Spaghetti.
Hanukkah or Rosh Hashanah?
Hanukkah.
All right.
At least I get a gift.
Paul Simon? Paul Simon or James Taylor?
Oh, my God. I love them both.
You can't pick?
Paul Simon.
Okay. Fucking Bob Dylan or Donovan?
I love Donovan. I like Donovan.
All right. You did very well, Steven. You're amazing. I love you.
What did I win? What's my prize?
Nothing. Just my love.
All right. Thank you. This was all what I always wanted that.
Well, you got it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, man. I appreciate you putting up with me.
Thank you, brother Dave. Have a wonderful night, and thank you so much, sir.
Thank you, and I hope I see you sometime. That would be amazing.
You will. As soon as I see you, you're getting a hug.
All right, Steven.
Love
you too. You too, man. Thank
you
so much.
Thanks,
bye-bye. Total fucking thrill to have Steven Adler on Dopey. I grew up listening to Guns N' Roses. I remember just that music moved me. Steven's book moved me. Fucking very generous guy, very kind guy. Spoke to him on the phone before he ever called in. And just a really nice man. And thank you very much for coming on the show. I hope you come on again. It will be awesome. He has a book coming out called, like, Stories I Don't Remember, which would have been really funny to talk about on Dopey, but we're going to talk about it next time, where he has people sending in fucking drug stories that happened to him with the people that he doesn't remember. He has, like, a website where you can go to the website and tell a story that he doesn't remember, which is very, very dopey. Now, I want to read an email. It's from a guy named Quincy Gray McMichael, and I just really liked this email, and I just wanted to read it. It says, "Hey, Dave, I hope that this email reaches you and that life is treating you well. You are doing a great job keeping the dopey magic alive, though I know you miss Chris more than any of us dopes can really know, even though we miss him too. And I know that. You know, I do miss Chris a ton, and I do know that you guys miss him too. He was so good on the show, and he was obviously one of my best friends. And the show was just so easy and fun with him. So I love Chris. Totally miss him. Anyway, back to the email. Blah, blah, blah. Even though we miss him too. I am writing to let you know about an upcoming event. Granted, it is in West Virginia, so you may not be able to attend. But if you can, you are my guest, and we would love to have you attend gratis, which means free. Healing Appalachia is an annual concert whose mission is to fight opiate addiction in Appalachia. Due to a number of generational societal issues in this area, not to mention the ruthlessness of the disease of addiction in general, West Virginia and the surrounding states are undoubtedly afflicted. I recall hearing a voicemail from at least one West Virginian member of the Dopey Nation on a recent show, and I know there must be others too. That was Jake from West Virginia with the amazing Good So Bad cover. Regardless, this is a show and a cause worth traveling for. I am posting the lineup below, and we have been contacted by even more notable acts for next year. We will have speakers in between sets, all-day meetings, and vendors with food. There is also camping available on-site. If you are willing, I would appreciate it if you can mention this on Dopey, in case anyone is interested in coming. Anyone who is curious can follow us on Instagram at Healing Appalachia, Facebook at Healing Appalachia, or buy tickets at the website healingappalachia.org. As a board member, I manage the social media, so dopes can reach out that way if so inclined. Thanks again, and keep up your good work, Dave. Make today a great day. Q. Yeah, so I love that. Healing Appalachia. I don't think I'm going to be able to go, but maybe next year we could do some sort of dopey event at Healing Appalachia and really get it going. Let's just – some of the people who are performing are Tyler Childers, Kelsey Walden, Justin Wells, The Wild Rumpus, Half Bad, the Half Bad Bluegrass Band, or is it the Wild Rumpus Half Bad Bluegrass Band? I wonder. Tickets $30. On the day of show, it's $35. Jake, you should fucking get a gig on this thing. You guys should book Jake. It's fucking good. Anyway, thank you, Quincy. Love that email. Love the invitation, and I love that it sounds like a really good cause. I'm going to play another voicemail. It's like one thing that Chris always would say on the show is the backlog of voicemails and emails. And I just, it's true. You know, after he died, like I said before, I went nuts on the phone. But even so, like, I was just perusing some of the old emails, and there are so many people that reached out right when he died, and I was, like, pretty crazy. So I didn't really respond to everybody, and I didn't read a bunch of them. But hopefully I'll be able to play more. Now, this voicemail is, like, the sound quality is so bad, it'll make Chris roll over in his grave. But it is from old school Dopey Nation member and contributor, this guy Daniel Herron. If you guys remember, he has a podcast called Released into Captivity that Chris went on. Chris and Jed from Church and Other Drugs went on his podcast, and he did one of the best dopey voicemails ever, where, like, he had robbed somebody of jewels and he hid out in some girl's lawn. It was just a classic, classic voicemail. Now, this voicemail is a great voicemail, except the sound quality is terrible. But ignore the sound quality. Hear Daniel's heart talking to you. And here he is.
What's up, Dave? It's so weird, man. Like, I always used to just say, what's up, Chris? What's up, Dave? Just so that, you know, you would get your feelings hurt that I didn't say Dave first. You know, and I was sitting one, you know, a few weeks ago talking to one of the brothers in the fellowship, and I saw on Facebook, you know, that Chris was gone, you know, and you know, I never met you guys. I always wanted to go to New York and meet you guys, and I never had a chance to, you know. I mean, I'm early in recovery. I'm 14 months, almost 15 months, and you know, it's been a bumpy road. But, like, if it wasn't... like, if it wasn't for you and Chris, like, I never would have done Released into Captivity. And even though I've been slacking off on it, you know, life happens, and I never would have done it, man. You know, I used to text back and forth to Chris, and he would just tell me, just do it, you know, just do it, man. Forget about how good it is. And just like Dave, you were saying how you used to get, you used to know that dopey sucked, and Chris would just be like, whatevs, you know, like, whatevs. He was like, just do it, man. Just put it out there and just do it. And I didn't realize until, you know, much later on, like, how important your guys' podcast was to me really early on in recovery. You know, those first 30 days, 60 days, 90 days when shit's just crazy in your head and you just want to get high, you don't know how to live any other way. And just listening to you guys and, you know, hearing Chris's crazy ass stories, you know, made me feel a part of, you know, it made me feel like it feels when I go into the rooms, like I'm not the only crazy fucker out there, you know, that it's just sad. Just sad, you know, like, so I had Chris and Jed come on to my show, and I think Jed had it on one of their episodes. And I remember Chris tells the story about Orange County Jail, because that was sort of our connection, Orange County Jail in California, you know. And he's telling a story about being on a bus ride and, you know, like, they had the women segregated in a cage in the front of the bus, and the men would be in the back of the bus, and, like, how these, you know, a guy and his girlfriend were there, and anyways, he finger bangs her through the cage. It's like chicken wire. And I remember after that episode, man, I was just, after we recorded, I was just torn, like, do I really want to play this story? I don't know why it bothered me so much, because I'm brutally honest, you know, with my recovery and with people. But it just was like, my mom listens to this, so I wanted my mom to hear this. But the reality of it was that it was true. Like, because I'd seen that stuff happen on county bus. Like, that was the hard truth, that shit happened, you know? And the hard truth is that this shit happens, man. Whether we like it or not, it feels like shit. You know, your friend is gone. I consider him my friend. He's gone. This is the hard truth of this fucked up disease, man, is that we're all eligible. Every one of us. No one is above it. Like, if you think for 1 second, Dopey Nation, that you have however many years, I don't give a shit how many it is, if you think for 1 second that you're beyond a relapse, that it's not gonna happen to you, you're fucking nuts, dude. Like, that's your disease talking to you. Like, you need to call someone and you need to talk to someone, because that is a lie. Straight up lie. Like, we are all eligible, man. Like, I can blink my eyes and be loaded. I can blink my eyes and my arm will be at the end of a needle in no time, and that could be my last one. And so, like, it fucked me up, because, like, my best friend relapsed. I have one sponsee, he relapsed and ended up in rehab. And at the same time, like, I look on social media and, you know, Chris is gone, you know? And so it had me fucked up, but thankfully, like, I'm not alone, you know? Like, Dopey Nation, you're not alone. Like, if you're out there and you're just barely getting clean, like, you're not alone. If you're out there and you just relapsed, you're not alone. If you're out there getting loaded, you know, like, that's what we do, man. Like, I know there's not going to be judgment from Dave. We maybe a little bit, but we'll reflect and realize that we were right there, you know? And it really helped me, because I feel like I've been in relapse mode, not really to get loaded, but just with other things, people, places, and things. And my life is fucking good. You know, I'm gonna drive to Sacramento tomorrow, and I'm gonna do, what I love to do, and advocate for criminal justice reform. And if it wasn't for you guys encouraging me to do this podcast, I don't think I'd be doing that. Because as a result of my podcast, I ended up in an elevator with the guy that was the policy leader of a team that goes and advocates for change, especially for young people. And now I advocate for policy change, and I get to go and advocate in front of lawmakers. And if it was me, if it wasn't for Chris and Dave's podcast encouraging me, and for the ones on the county jail episodes, I wouldn't be doing that, man. And that service is a huge part of my life and my recovery. So I fucking love you, Dave. You know, and I love you, man. And I miss Chris. And look, man, you're not alone out there, Dopey Nation. You're never alone. You can call someone, you can go to a meeting, you're never alone. Stay strong. Peace out.
Love that fucking voicemail, Daniel Heron. Thank you so much. So powerful. For real. You know, we've all been there, and no, I wouldn't judge you. Thank you, Daniel. I feel for you guys, and I wish that this hadn't had to happen the way it did. But and I hate to say that Chris dying really carries the Dopey message, but it really actually does. Chris had his shit together. Chris knew everything. Chris had just the greatest life on paper ever, and he wasn't satisfied, and he missed using, and he used, and he died. And I think that is an amazing message for you guys to pay attention to. And I'm going to leave it with that. Thank you, Daniel. Thank you, Steven Adler. Thank you, Chris from Austin. Thank you, Quincy from West Virginia. Thank you, Dopey Nation. Thank you, Dad. My dad came through, as always. Thank you, Dope Sick Nation. What are we going to do about the Dope Sick Nation, guys? What are we going to do? What are we going to do about Artie? You guys writing reviews? You guys sending in voicemails, emails, Reddit, Instagram, Twitter? Fucking A. Buy a hat. Who's buying hats? If you buy a hat, send in a picture, because I want to, like, post the pictures of you guys in your hats, and I'll dopey out the eyes if you want. We're going to be shirts. There's going to be crap. Live Dopey is totally postponed. I knew it was going to get postponed, and she was like, no, the club is opening on October 20th, but it's not. It's totally postponed. Who knows when? To be determined. Maybe I'll rent a theater. Dopey Nation, talk amongst yourselves and see what you think. So stay strong, everybody, and toodles for Chris, and we love you, and love you guys, and keep your heads together. Bye.
I want to take a walk around the world. I wonder would it do me any good. Until I get some money in my pocket, then I guess I'll just have to walk around my neighborhood. But I want to be good so bad. Want to be so good, so bad, so bad. I want to be good so bad. Bad desire's all I ever had. And I want to take a ride up in the sky. Watch as airplanes just pass me by. And I want to see a Lear jetliner take a dive. Just to show all of these people what it means to be alive. But I want to be good so bad. Want to be so good, so bad, so bad. I want to be good so bad. Bad desire's all I ever had. And my shadow's getting smaller and smaller. And it's time to where I stand. Shadow's getting smaller and smaller. And it's time to where I stand. And I wonder would they pay it any mind when I leave this busted city far behind. I'll take the high road however far it winds, because peace and love are very, very, very hard to find. And I wanna be good so bad.